Welcome back to Midpoint, my friends. On January 21st, 2026, year two of living with our mad king, the talking yam, and all of the chaos and despair he has brought to America in his return to power. You know, we could spend forever talking about him, but we won't, because we have other things, other issues, and other information to cover today. I'm your host, Shelley Reback, and my guest today is local nutritionist Wendy Wesley. We'll be talking to Wendy about the new nutrition guidelines recently put out by Trump and RFK Jr.'s Department of Health and Human Services, and about all the things food and diet in just a few minutes after our Florida news nuggets. We are in week two of the most dangerous time of the year in Florida, the 90 days or more in this case, of the Republican-controlled Florida legislative session, where good ideas for making life better for Floridians go to die, and where bad ideas that hurt the quality of life for Floridians always come out on top. The horror has already begun as we see Florida growing more and more extreme every year. So far, in its first week and first full floor session of 2026, the Florida House of Representatives has already passed bills to give fertilized eggs some of the same legal rights as living children. They also repealed a bipartisan gun safety law passed after the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School to lower the age for purchasing firearms from 21 back down to 18. And they are protecting a giant mining corporation from lawsuits over radioactive material left behind on their former mine sites. We talked about all three of these bills last week, and now they have passed the House. It should come as no surprise, really, that lobbyists for Mosaic Mining Company wrote the bill to block lawsuits over radiation on former mines. As Jason Garcia of Seeking Rents reports, the legislation is designed to help Mosaic redevelop some of the more than 200 square miles of former phosphate mines that it owns across the southern interior of Florida. This bill would effectively immunize the company against certain kinds of legal claims under our tough environmental laws. Their goal is to snuff out any lingering risk of lawsuits so that the company can redevelop their land or sell it off to other real estate developers without fear of future claims from homeowners exposed to elevated levels of radiation. To be clear, the Republicans in the Florida legislature are helping a Fortune 500 company knowingly expose Floridians to possibly dangerous radioactive homes without any recourse for the people who are possibly going to be injured by them. And it will easily pass in the Florida Senate. Mosaic has been working on this issue with one of the most powerful people in Tallahassee, Senate President Ben Albritton, a Republican whose district includes most of the Mosaic land. This would be such an extraordinary betrayal of the duties of public servants representing the people if it wasn't for the betrayals of the public we have seen from the U.S. Congress and the Trump administration in the last year. It's no longer extraordinary. Now, this kind of craven self-interest over the interests of constituents just seems to be the order of the day from Republicans. Similarly, the bill to lower the age to purchase firearms. Why? Beyond the NRA and the Second Amendment absolutists, who wants this? How does this make Floridians any safer and more secure from gun violence? And yesterday, our own Pam Bondi, U.S. Attorney General, indicated that she is considering lowering what little federal restrictions on gun purchases we have in America. In what world are these changes going to improve our lives? It makes no sense. And the fetal personhood bill. I find it hard to even talk about a bill that would treat a fetus the same as a living child. You're clear on what this bill really is, right? This is just another step in making it impossible for any abortion at any time, even within the first 6 weeks, which is the current legal restriction, for any abortion to be protected under Florida law. This is another brick in the cell walls that Republicans are building to control and confine the lives of women in Florida, to make it impossible for a woman in Florida to manage her reproductive life and thereby to manage her family life, her professional life, even to manage her health. If this enrages you, as it does me, you may be interested to know that the Planned Parenthood of Florida Gala is scheduled for February 27th at the Hilton in downtown Tampa, and you can register to attend it at ppfl.org/Tampa Gala, all one word. All right, let's get to the topic of the day, food. This year, there have been many new developments in the world of food, diet, and nutrition. And as it is a new year, and so many of us have made goals to be eating healthier, maybe to lose weight, maybe trying dry January. Each January, I like to bring in some expertise to help us meet those goals. So today, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Midpoint St. Pete nutritionist Wendy Wesley, who is going to talk with us all about food. So welcome back, Wendy.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Sure. Let's begin with the big news out of Washington, the new dietary food pyramid that RFK Jr. has been touting as part of his MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, campaign. Now, once again, the new dietary guidelines recommend that Americans change their food habits. What are the main takeaways from this change? The old food pyramid was, I think, promulgated in 1992, and it looks like this is a very significant reversal of what was recommended then and since. So what is the new food pyramid? What does it look like?
Well, we had an old food pyramid, and now we have a new food pyramid. But what a lot of people don't know is in the middle of that was My Plate.
Oh, yeah, My Plate.
And nobody ever asked me about My Plate, or nobody ever talked about the Dietary Guidelines for Americans ever. This is my fifth cycle studying the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which a committee is convened every 5 years to determine the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. And this is the first time in my career, I've been practicing for 10 years, that anyone has asked my opinion about a pyramid or a plate or any kind of guidelines. So quite honestly, I'm excited that we have a conversation, that people are thinking about it and talking about it.
Well, you know, the pyramid, it seems, you know, kind of silly, but at the same time, these guidelines themselves are really important because they do shape the foods that are served in schools, hospitals, prisons, military bases, and through federal assistance programs. So, like, whatever the federal food pyramid is, whatever the federal food guidelines are, that is going to basically guide, you know, all these different federal programs that provide food. So, you know, a significant portion of our population will have their food, not their preferences, but the availability of food influenced by these.
Yeah. All federally supported food programs will follow these guidelines. And then these are just recommendations for Americans to follow. But of course, Americans can eat, make choices exactly how we want to. But like I said, I'm thrilled that we're just having a conversation about what's in them.
Well, my main takeaways from looking at these new guidelines were that they're telling us now to eat more protein and more fats and less white carbs, breads, and pasta. That seems to be the, you know, the main difference. You know, before, at the bottom of the food pyramid, which was what you should eat most of, was bread, you know, pasta, white carbs, things like that. And at the very tippy top was, you know, red meats. For now, the new pyramid seems to be the reverse, you know, where, you know, meat and dairy are at the bottom and, you know, carbs are at the top.
Yeah, the pyramid is essentially inverse. It's an upside down triangle now. And so at the top, indicating where the heaviest consumption should be, are, you're right, animal proteins and some plant proteins. And in my nutrition practice, I'm pushing for plant proteins I'm not vegetarian or vegan myself, but as I get older and as I study nutrition more and understand it better, I am significantly consuming more plant proteins and fewer animal proteins. And that's because I want the fiber. I want the minerals, vitamins, antioxidants that are found in plants. I also want to keep my cholesterol low, have good heart health, and keep my and not put on weight. And so I do that with plant proteins, and that is the primary focus of my nutrition practice, are plant proteins.
Well, you know, we agree that these guidelines are going to seriously affect any federal food programs, but isn't it true that, like, taste and cost are more significant influencers of what people eat than whatever federal bureaucrats say? I mean, unless you're getting your food from a federal program, you're going to be more concerned with the cost of your food and, you know, frankly, your taste. It's interesting to me. Why are Republicans, the party of personal rights and freedom, that's in air quotes for you people out in listener land, why are Republicans habitually telling people what to eat? You know, I mean, it just seems like something that is antithetical to their whole, you know, philosophy.
Yeah, that whole laissez-faire kind of idea, you know, hands off. And then here they, you know, come in and charge and, you know, like a bull in a china shop, like cramming these down our throat.
Yeah,
on the other hand,
you know, if letting people be guided simply by cost and taste makes them unhealthy, then I suppose it's, you know, it's a good thing that people are being counseled to change their dietary habits. But these particular new guidelines seem somewhat suspect to me. They're a big reversal from the past guidelines, and they seem kind of overly political with their emphasis on meat and dairy. You know, after years of being told to limit red meat and foods high in fats, now we're being told to eat more of them. Let me just throw out a few facts here. They're recommending more dairy consumption, for example. It makes me wonder why, because in the 2024 cycle, total federal contributions from individuals and PACs associated with the dairy industry reached approximately $4 million, and historically, the dairy industry consistently favors Republicans, typically allocating between 71 and 74% of its donations to the GOP. So should we really be consuming more dairy? I know that there's been a huge growth in plant-based milks and products. Like, you know, you can go into Starbucks and get like three different kinds of plant-based milks rather than half and half or whole milk in your coffee. But I want to know, are plant-based milk products better? Should we really be consuming more whole milk dairy products, or should we be consuming plant milk products?
I get this question a lot, and the other question I get a lot is, if you could make one change to the American food system, what would that one change be? And I would say I would remove flavored milk from our school lunch and breakfast system. Flavored milks can have as much as 20 to 25 grams of added sugar. And when I say flavored milks, I mean chocolate and strawberry. And so from a very, very young age, we are plowing very young children with incredible amounts of added sugar, which sets their palate up to crave, consume, and demand more sugar throughout the lifetime. This generation, my son is 19 and his generation is Gen Z, and then millennials coming after them or before them. These generations have had lifetime exposure to ultra-processed food and high amounts of added sugar, primarily starting from flavored milk in our school lunch and breakfast system.
And we've now know how dangerous that is, that sugar is like an addictive substance. It's like, you know, a drug. And, you know, I think research has shown, you know, the influence of sugar on kids' behavior in school, on their sleep patterns, on their ability to learn and that type of thing. So, okay, we're hearing about the sugar, but what about these plant milks? Are they, you know, I mean, I hear that the three villains of the food world right now in contemporary society are, you know, dairy, gluten, and sugar. And I wonder, is that legit, or are we being sold a bill of goods on those things?
Sometimes I think, especially where we're talking about gluten, it's a reductionist form of nutrition conversation, because I think things like seed oils and gluten, they are distractors. They are distractors from the big problem. And the big problem is that, in my opinion, as a dietitian, we are eating way too much ultra-processed food. And if gluten can come along and distract us for 6 months from the big picture, cool. If seed oils can come and distract us for another 12 months from the big picture, cool. This means that big food makes big profits, and they roll on unabated, and we are focused on these little individual ingredients. And in my opinion, that's the big conversation.
So the big conversation that we should be having is about the evils of ultra-processed foods, in your opinion.
In my opinion.
And this is based
on 10 years of working with people, just every day, in and out, talking to people about what kinds of patterns of eating, styles of eating, and ingredients contribute to disease.
And so right now, I think we can all agree, except maybe big food, we can all agree that ultra-processed foods are bad and fruits and vegetables are good. In fact, there's a new lawsuit against big food, isn't there, coming out of the city of San Francisco. They're suing some manufacturers of ultra-processed foods and alleging that they are unsafe and unhealthy. So I think it would be important to talk to our listeners about what is ultra-processed foods, and are they actually causing health risks and diet-related illnesses, even mental health risks?
Right. I'm a follower and a believer in this British physician. His name is Chris Van Tulleken, and he
wait,
wrote
Chris Van what?
Van Tulleken. Chris Van Tulleken.
Okay.
He wrote a book called Ultra Processed People, and I use his definition for an ultra processed food. One, it comes in a package, and just because a food comes in a package does not inherently make it ultra-processed or bad or good.
Right. Publix puts all their vegetables in plastic packaging.
Sure. So one, an ultra-processed food will always come in a package. And then two, it contains one ingredient that you or I cannot walk into Publix right now and pull off the shelf.
Oh, that's a good way to define it, right?
Right,
any
right.
One ingredient, huh? Right.
So I can't walk into Publix today and ask the clerk, hey, can you direct me to the aisle where I can find some xanthan gum, right? It doesn't exist. Or certain stabilizers, flavorings, other dough conditioners, other kinds of things. These things don't exist in grocery stores. So if there's one ingredient on the list that you can't find in a modern grocery store, that's an indicator that it's an ultra-processed food. And then number three, it will often have a health claim.
This is a healthy product?
Right. Great source of dairy, a great source of calcium, a good source of fiber, meets all your requirements. You know, minimally processed and unprocessed foods don't have billion-dollar marketing departments behind them, but ultra-processed foods do, and the way they get us to continue to purchase their product is by making health claims. And I love to say that the big food business playbook, a couple of things. They engineer food that is meant to be eaten on repeat in mass quantities. That's the big food playbook. And then the other thing is, and this is the oldest story of industry, we create a problem or a fear that doesn't really exist, or that it's not a real fear or problem. And then we bring to market the answer to the problem or the fear. And that is another big kind of tactic by big food.
That's interesting. You know, one of the other things I noticed in prepping for this show about these new federal food guidelines are that even though there's no scientific evidence, for example, that supports that it's more healthy to eat more meat, eat more dairy, cook with butter and beef tallow, for example, all recommendations that the MAHA movement and RFK Jr. Tout. Nonetheless, Kennedy brought in his own experts to formulate these new guidelines. But 5 out of 10 of the experts that are on his advisory committee disclosed their recent financial relationships with the beef, the dairy, and the pork industries, or infant formula, supplements even, and pharmaceutical companies. These are all people on this advisory committee who have a financial stake, or their businesses have a financial stake in what appear in these federal guidelines, because, you know, the amount of food that's purchased through these federal programs is just enormous.
Right. There are some problems with the current dietary guidelines recommendations. One of them is the protein recommendations are way, in my opinion, way too high.
Okay, let's talk about that, because from my social media feeds, it looks like Americans are obsessed with getting more protein. I mean, don't Americans already get enough protein, like from their diet? I mean, I guess if they're just eating, like, you know, my fantasy meal of ranch-flavored potato chips or something all day, every day, I guess they're not getting enough protein. But from a regular diet of a mixed diet of foods without an over-reliance on ultra-processed foods, wouldn't they be getting enough protein? And another question, where should we be getting our protein from? Again, from my social media feeds, it's like one protein shake after another, that you're supposed to be eating protein that's enough grams of protein that match your goal weight, that's a lot of protein in my case. I mean, where should we be getting our protein? From these shakes, from meat? Do we really need these protein supplements? You know, what should people be getting in terms of protein?
So here's the we're all doing just fine on protein. Americans are doing just fine on protein. We're all easily, with the food we eat, regular old food, easily making our protein, getting our protein needs met. Now, when I worked I was trained in a hospital over in St. Petersburg, and our protein recommendations for our patients were 0.8 grams to 1 gram per kilogram. So for an average size woman, that's about 60 to 70 grams a day. And for a man, that might be 80 or 90 grams a day. Okay. Many of my patients say, well, my personal trainer told me to have 1 gram of protein per pound.
Right. That's what I hear on social media.
So I hear these women say, so I'm trying to get 140 grams of protein in a day. And I say, how's that working for you? And she says, I'm killing myself eating all this protein. And I say, it's because you are never meant to have that much protein. Eating that kind of protein, and I've known a couple of bodybuilders who say when they are in an active period of time where they are building muscle, they have to eat a lot of protein, and for them it feels like a second full-time job. It is hard to get that much protein. It requires a lot of money, a lot of shopping, a lot of preparation, and a lot of thought and emphasis on protein. And so I made up a phrase. We Americans are over-proteinated, and we are way under-fiberated. That's another word I just made up. So
fiber seems to be the next big thing on my social media feed, that we're told we're not eating enough fiber. And, you know, my view on this is, and you know, pardon me out there in listener land for being indelicate, but the fact is, if you're eating that much protein, like 140 grams of protein, you're going to be constipated, which means you need more fiber. So I think one follows the other, because, fiber is supposed to be something that you need for what my mother used to call roughage.
Roughage, right? Roughage.
How much fiber should we be eating, and where should we be getting our fiber? You know, chia seeds is a big thing. Hemp, flakes is a big thing. I mean, psyllium is a big thing. Where, you know, are these, is it good to take those kinds of like quasi food products as a way to get fiber?
Yeah, and no. So when we consume fiber from things like Metamucil or psyllium or other things that come from a factory, when we consume fiber that comes from a factory, we are leaving on the factory floor minerals, vitamins, antioxidants, and protein. We're leaving, and fats. We're leaving all of these other micro and macronutrients on the cutting room floor, if you will, in just the heavy pursuit of this one thing, which is, again, that reductionist nutrition argument, is that we're just going to focus on one macro, one micro, one protein, one thing. Nutrition is a big picture. And the best diets are big, and they're varied, and they have a lot of variety. And they're also not based in marketing. They're not based in factory foods, and they're not based in fear.
So, you know, Gretchen has written in to ask, well, what are the best fruits, veggies, and legumes that give us, you know, the best protein and fiber combination? I remember many years ago, and it is many years ago, when I was a vegetarian doing my research, I was always told beans and rice are the perfect protein complement, fiber and protein complement. Is that still true? Do we know anything better now? Or what should we be eating to get a good combination of real food, protein, and fiber?
I tell a couple of things. Your food should spoil. The food you have in your kitchen should have an expiration date. It should grow mold and spores. It should wilt and die. And so that's kind of a...
Well, first you should eat it, you so you don't it. Get to you that should, phase.
Right,
because we don't want to waste. But
if your food has... If there's a lot of ultra-processed foods that are manufactured 2 years ago, warehoused for a year and a half, and sit on the grocery stores for 6 months before it's purchased and eaten. And it is engineered to not spoil. And so, first and foremost, your food should it should be alive, and it should spoil as much as you can. I just lost my train of thought, but the best, people say, Wendy, what's the best vegetable? And the answer is the one that makes it into your belly. That's my answer. What's the best fruit? What's the best bean? It's the one that gets in your belly. And so whether that's fresh, frozen, organic, non-organic, GMO, non-GMO, frozen, canned, I don't care. So the first tenet of social work is we meet people where they are. And so we have to find out where is your budget? Where are your culturally, who are you with food? What kind of kitchen equipment do you have? What kind of skill set do you have? What kind of time do you have? And then I work with people that way. So we have to really meet people where they are with food. I hate all of these big rules around food. I do have one kind of rule with food. Does your food look like it just left the farm, or does it look like it just came off a truck out of the back of a factory? Some may say, you know, there's a lot of people who can only afford ultra-processed food, and that's where SNAP cuts and SNAP benefits had a massive impact on people. And there's a lot of great community programs out there that's putting fresh produce into the community. So what I like for everyone in healthcare to do is to kind of assess where someone is and make small, sustainable changes that will last the lifetime.
That's really good advice, I think. I mean, because really, what is the point of telling people they must have farm fresh vegetables if they're living in a food desert, for example, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I commend you for that, discussing it that way, as opposed to throwing out these rules about what is best and what is ideal and what you should be doing. I mean, because there's so much guilt around food,
yeah,
too,
there is.
Whether it's about what you can't afford to eat, or whether what your guilty pleasure is, like my ranch flavored potato chips. You know, you can't. Yeah, there's so much guilt around food. I think a lot of people have, and one of the things about a dietitian, a nutritionist, I imagine, is helping people get over that kind of guilt that they have about their food choices and helping them to make better choices and not be controlled by their
craving. One of the things I like to do with my patients is I call it add to. So we're not taking away food, but can we identify one bean, one nut, one seed, one piece of fruit, one vegetable, just one thing that we can add to? That's it. That's it. And that might sound kind of counterintuitive because people come to me for weight loss and they think, oh, she's going to take away all my food. And I say, what if we could just identify something that you know how to buy, you know how to store? Because food storage, I spend a lot of time on food storage. It's teaching people how to properly store produce. Do you know how to buy it? Do you know how to store it? Do you know how to cook it? Do you know how to eat it? These are all like, and also setting up the environment of the home and the kitchen. This is all like, food is complicated and it takes a long time. I don't want people to think that this is unattainable. In fact, I think that we have put food and nutrition too so far on the back burner. Sometimes I talk to my patients and it almost feels like food for them is an annoying gnat. I just got to eat and get on to the next thing. And sometimes I ask people, what is the next thing? And often the next thing is scrolling social media, watching a television show, or something else. And so sometimes what I do with nutrition counseling is helping people understand what is the thing that is replacing focus and attention on food and nutrition. Because a lot of people, I think, especially post-pandemic, a lot of my patients fell into the habit of, they downloaded apps to their phone, Uber Eats and DoorDash, and they became accustomed to, I guess, hedonistic eating, that is the world of restaurant food. Now, I love restaurant food, but a daily or a twice daily dose of restaurant food is a fast ticket to disease, in my opinion. The salt, the added sugar, the large portions. We're just not meant to eat like that every day. So post-pandemic, there were a lot of downloads of these apps and people became accustomed and their budgets became accustomed to eating out in restaurants instead of cooking at home. The other thing that I observed happened during the pandemic was a lot of late night eating, where a lot of people maybe before the pandemic did not have a late night eating issue. But because of frustration, fear, loneliness, boredom, all of those things, they developed habits where they were eating late overnight. And typically the foods that are eaten late at night are not chicken breast and carrot sticks.
Right.
They are ultra-processed variety.
Right. Now, I've read too, though, that if you're eating, that one of the ways to reduce or prevent late night eating is to eat early in the morning, is to eat breakfast. I don't know. I'm not a breakfast person. It's very difficult for me to roll out of bed, you know, and have a substantial meal first thing in the morning. But I read that, you know, if you have a substantial meal in the morning, especially a meal that's filled with protein, it's going to help you avoid late night eating. Do you ascribe to that?
I don't ascribe to anyone eating when they're actually not hungry. So we are all born with natural hunger and satiety cues that are driven by hormones. And society and parents and TikTok and I Heard and Instagram beat that out of us. Absolutely beat that out of us. And so we are all born with with hunger and satiety cues. If people can delay that first bite in the morning until true hunger comes on. I love when my patients say, you know what, I wasn't really hungry at 10, but at 11, 11:30, I could feel my hunger hormones start to talk to me. And I said, and that's when you go into the kitchen and you have something nutrient dense. when I say nutrient dense, I mean adequate protein, not high protein. I use the term adequate protein. And this is the protein that we need to fuel our bodies and repair muscles and do all the things we do. And then something with some fiber and some micronutrients, because a good choice will beget a good choice. So we can get to that first meal of the day, something good with fiber and adequate protein. I love breakfast tacos. So I love to scramble up some eggs and maybe some beans, tomatoes, and spinach and put it inside of a tortilla. And you know what? I put a little ranch dressing on it. Mm-hmm. Because I also think that food should be pleasurable and joyful. And this is punitive eating. We don't get there. Mm. We will eat in a hateful, punitive way for about 3 or 4 days. We'll white knuckle through it and we'll say, to hell with this, Wendy. I'm miserable. I'm going back to my old style of eating. So when I counsel patients, I'm always looking for joy and pleasure in food. It's got to be there.
Mm. All right. Well, I certainly, appreciate that as a cook, because I'm a cook. So it's no skin off my nose to make a meal. But there are plenty of people who are not cooks, you know, who are afraid of the kitchen. I think that's a big problem in adequate nutrition, isn't it? It's like you discussed with the DoorDash people, the restaurant people. I think learning how to cook at home is something that automatically improves your nutrition, right?
Well, in my kitchen, all good meals start with an onion. And so I teach cooking classes, and I want to put a knife in everyone's hand, and I want to teach them how to just dice an onion. We just start with an onion, maybe a tomato and a pepper. A lot of people I observe are afraid of knives, and so I teach knife sharpening classes, and I teach knife skills classes. Mm-hmm. I just did an awesome class at Eckerd College. It's Knife Skills for Life Skills. I had 35 college students in the big auditorium, and we cut up a bunch of vegetables that we pulled from the Eckerd College garden. It was a great event. The students said they really enjoyed it because they have very, very little exposure. Some of them had very little exposure to knives and vegetables.
Yeah.
So the kids were growing the vegetables, but they didn't know how to cut them.
And then cook them.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the fact that there are so many diets out there that now purport to be the one true diet, you know? Perhaps the most well-known and universally approved diet is the Mediterranean diet. Let's talk about what is the Mediterranean diet, and what about some of these other variations like the DASH diet? Kelly Clarkson says she lost a lot of weight on the plant paradox diet. Tom Brady doesn't eat any nightshades like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, mushrooms, because he says they cause inflammation. What do you think about all those different diets? And what would be your recommendation for the one true diet?
Yeah, the best diet, the one true diet, is, in my opinion, the Mediterranean diet. And 80 to 90% of the Mediterranean diet is plants, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, beans, legumes, whole grains. There is some seafood, some lean meat, and some sugar. And that basically is the backbone of the Mediterranean diet is fiber, 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 fiber. There's lots and lots of protein in plants. We don't have to worry about not meeting our protein needs if we are vegan or a vegetarian.
So one of my emailers here who's asking about his ribeye, we don't need it. I mean, you can have it, right? But if you have it like in proportions of like 4 ounces, right? Maybe 6 ounces if you're a 300-pound guy or something.
Sure. The typical size, serving size of animal protein is for chicken or pork or beef is 3 ounces. And so if you'll hold out your hand, the size of your palm, and this is a relative measure because my palm is going to be smaller than a 250-pound man's palm, but it's a relative measure, is about 3 ounces. The size of your palm is about 3 ounces. The serving size of fish is your hand outstretched. That's about 5 or 6 ounces. Okay. If you make a fist, the volume of your fist is about 1 cup. That is the typical serving size of cold cereal. Is 1 cup.
Or any carb, really, like rice, for example?
Rice is lower
noodles.
Because noodles, it's all dependent on size, size of noodles. You can have this much rigatoni or this much orzo. You know, it all comes, it's all very, very specific to the size and the shape of the pasta. I primarily work with menopausal and postmenopausal women who want to lose weight. And the common denominator I see in their diets that are preventing them from losing weight are alcohol consumption, pasta, and bread, and other foods that come from refined flours. If I can help them replace these kinds of things, refined flours, and primarily in the form of pastas and breads and crackers and muffins and bagels and Starbucks and Dunkin', okay? The liquid calories are a big, big problem, just like the milk. Just like the flavored milk, the strawberry and chocolate milk, I think that the coffee drinks are a major, major issue. They're drivers of diabetes, in my opinion. If I can help a woman reduce her added sugar, increase her fiber, and reduce her intake of flour, I can help her lose weight. And what we do is we do this with swaps, just one at a time. Instead of this, let's try that. Instead of this, let's try that. Or maybe we try every other day. And if you're a daily Starbucks, we go to every other day and we find a suitable replacement for that off day.
Well, you know, you mentioned these carbs, these white carbs, mm-hmm. and getting people off them. So it seems like we need to talk about gluten. So why are so many people avoiding gluten when they don't have celiac disease? Is it really the flour that our American carb are made out of, or is sourdough bread, for example, better for you because it's quasi-fermented? You know, what about gluten? Is it really so many people I know say, oh, I don't eat gluten, as if like that's like a magic part of a diet, like weight reduction program.
Yeah.
Is that appropriate?
Americans love a one-stop shop. We love a pill. We love one ingredient. If I add this ingredient or reduce this ingredient, we love a one-stop shop. And so for a long time, it was gluten. And I think a lot of Americans hung their hopes that if they could eliminate gluten, they could finally reach their health goals. Then after that came protein. If I can just meet my protein goals, then I can finally meet my health goals, which whatever that is, diabetes, weight loss, improved cardiac disease, whatever it is. But I think primarily it was for weight loss. I think that protein was marketed to us hard and still continues to come at us marketing very, very hard that if you will only meet your protein goals, the weight will fall off. Of all the women in my practice, all the hundreds of women I've worked with over the 10 years to lose weight, not one of them has lost weight because of protein supplements, shakes, and bars, and other products. It is not the magic bullet.
Well, back to the gluten, though. I mean, should people be avoiding gluten?
Again, I think that gluten, it comes in that class of protein. It's this one thing, and veganism was another one. There was a period of time where I had a slew of patients coming to me saying, I want to be vegan, because I think they thought if they could eliminate meat, then they could finally lose weight or meet their health goals.
Yeah, that didn't work for me, because ranch potato chips were pretty much vegan. So
again, it's like, if I can just eliminate the gluten, then everything's fixed. That didn't happen. If I could just ramp up the protein, everything's fixed. That didn't happen. I think what happens is when people stop eating gluten, what happens is they automatically reduce their intake of ultra processed foods. And guess what? They feel better. Sodium goes down. Added sugar goes down. All kinds of other things go down. Then you have to eat something. And so if you're not eating gluten, then maybe you're eating other foods that maybe might have more nutrient density.
But these gluten-free products that are on the market now are very ultra-processed, right?
Yes. Even I've observed even more ultra-processed than other kinds of foods, because there's all kinds of chemistry that has to happen to create a mouthfeel and crunch and all of those other things that big food is constantly dialing it up, dialing it down to get it to this place. I'm sure many of you have heard of it, called the bliss point. And the bliss point is where the majority of consumers will find an ultra processed food perfect. And big food is always dialing it up, dialing it down, experimenting. And based on food trends, they have to go back into the lab and make some changes in order to meet. Well, people are clamoring for fiber. So big food will go into the lab and reformulate their foods so that they can ramp up the fiber. But they will always, first and foremost, meet the needs, the taste needs. And Bliss Point is not just about taste. It's about, how does it sound in my ear? How does it smell in my nose? How does it look coming out of the package? Even down to how does the package crinkle? There's a lot. When you really start to look at the world of ultra-processed food, you feel like it's like a David and Goliath world. Big food is big, and they are heavily funded, and that goes back to what we talked about in the beginning of who sits on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans committee. Since I've been looking at the Dietary Guidelines for Americans for this is my fifth cycle, it's very common for big food executives to leave their position and go sit on the Dietary Guidelines for Americans and make policy. And then they go right back to their jobs. So this is not something new with this iteration of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. It's not new. It's been going on since the dawn of time.
Okay, we are WMNF Radio Tampa, and we are here with Wendy Wesley, local nutritionist from St. Pete. We're talking all about food, diet, and nutrition today. And let me apologize to our listeners. We don't have a phone answerer today, so we have not been taking phone calls, and I wanted to let you know why. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send an email to dj@wmnf.org or a text to 813-239-9663. I wanted to just bring to your attention, Wendy, a couple of emails that we did get in already. David writes in that, "I know that some local farmers markets like Sweetwater can take food stamps as a payment option, but I think a lot of food stamp recipients don't know that." Mm-hmm. And also, we have questions from people asking about making healthier choices at a fast food restaurant. That's, you know, part of people's daily lives often. So many, many fast food restaurants let you switch out like fries for fruit, for example. But you need to ask for that. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I do a lot of educating about fast food because it would be irresponsible for me to say, well, just don't eat fast food. I'm not going to say that. That's not the real world we live in. But what if when you go through fast food, what if your beverage choice is zero calorie? Get the sandwich you want. Get the sandwich you want, but let's do a zero calorie beverage. Mm-hmm. Unsweet tea, water, even a diet drink. So we're not consuming all of these added sugars. Mm-hmm. And that's just, and again, I'm trying to meet people where they are. Like I said, irresponsible to say, don't do fast food. That's not the culture we live in. But what if we could do fast food and reduce the risk by reducing the added sugars that we consume in some of these very, very large, you know, Baja Blast or whatever. There's a lot of the most insidious calories, in my opinion, are liquid calories. Hmm. There's nothing to slow them down. They spike blood glucose almost instantly, and they provide no nutrition. So what if we could just do a zero calorie beverage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I have a bunch of emails here about people asking very specific questions about their own diets that I am kind of reluctant to bring to your attention because, you know, we have such a limited time here. But people are asking, is my instant coffee an ultra-processed food that I should give up? I'm a big person. Can I have more than 4 ounces of, you know, animal protein, things like that. I've got several of these backed up emails like that. And, I just wanted to ask you, you know, people having those kinds of questions. And again, as I said, I apologize, we don't have a phone answerer today. So we're not taking a lot of calls. But, you know, there are nutritionists in the community like you, for example, that can answer all those questions, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but many hospitals have outpatient nutrition programs that will work with your insurance. I work for a telehealth nutrition company, And they manage the insurance. So I work with patients, and the company manages the insurance, and I see them through Zoom. And I've got, I don't know, 50 patients right now, 50 patients alone on GLP-1s and tirzepatides right now.
Yeah, we didn't even get to talk about the GLP-1s. Let's see if we can do that kind of quickly. So the GLP-1s, right? We've learned a lot about them since the last time you were here on Midpoint when they were still pretty new, like 3 years ago. One of the things I notice is we've learned that if you go off them, as many older patients do, both because of cost, because most Medicare, for example, does not cover any GLP-1 drugs, so you're out of pocket. Even the direct purchase options through Eli Lilly, for example, will not give you the discounts if you're a Medicare recipient. I don't understand that, because you would think that, you know, older people who would be more subject to potentially being pre-diabetic, for example, because I think you can get them if you're diabetic, but not if you're pre-diabetic. You know, they won't give the discount. They won't cover them through Medicare insurance, and you're kind of screwed. But we noticed that so many old people are going off them, and they regain about two-thirds of their weight back in 18 months. That seems to be the standard. So, you know, what about GLP-1s? What about microdosing them to stay on them forever, if you can afford them? Mm-hmm. We've seen a rash of new compound pharmacies offering them. People are making big, big money. We don't know what's in those compound pharmacy formulations of GLP-1 drugs. Give us your take on it quickly.
It's taken me a while to come around. I like these drugs. They give people who, what I call, or what a patient said to me, the monster of food noise. These drugs allow the food noise, the monster, to get off my back for a minute so I can stop and take a breath and say, what do I really want to eat? My patients tell me that the food noise, the monster, is on their, breathing down their neck hard, and they are grabbing for whatever is fast and convenient, and they're stuck in a cycle of overeating, primarily on what I call hedonistic food, very, very sugary food, ultra-processed food, very, very salty food. These drugs give them a minute to say, okay, wait a minute, let me shop, let me plan, let me think, let me experiment. The weight is coming off, and the ones who tolerate it well. My most successful patients will take these drugs, what I like to say, from the neck up, meaning that there is mindfulness and thought and journaling involved with taking these drugs. My least successful patients are the ones who take it primarily and from the neck down, meaning they just let the drug drive the bus, and they're just kind of along for the ride, and they're not thinking, how is food different? Who do I want to be as an eater? What kind of food do I actually like? So I like these drugs. I think that they're here to stay, and I love working with patients who take them.
All right. Well, we only have a couple minutes, but you mentioned journaling. So one of the things I wanted to ask you are, do you recommend any particular apps for people who want to monitor their food intake? Mm-hmm. You know, they're figure out their macros on the food that they are eating, and that type of thing. Because a lot of what you've recommended is sort of intuitive eating, but there are people who, unless they keep a record of it, or you know, that kind of journaling, don't pay enough attention to whatever their intuition is telling them. So very quickly, can you give us some apps that people can use?
I came up with a thing called the 3-3 method, which is per serving, I'd like the added sugar to be lower than 3 and the fiber to be higher than 3 grams. And so I like an app called Chronometer, because it is one of the few apps I've found that will actually track your added sugar. I don't think at this point that my FitnessPal will track added sugar, and some other ones don't, but Chronometer will tell you your added sugar. And so,
is it free or cost?
It's free.
Okay.
It's free. And
My FitnessPal has a free option. Mm-hmm.
It tells you potassium too, which is a nutrient of concern. We are chronically deficient on potassium, and potassium can protect against heart disease.
All right. I wish we had more time, but that is it. That's all we've got time for. I want to thank my guest, nutritionist Wendy Wesley, for joining us today on Midpoint. Wendy, if folks want more information from you, where can they find you?
WendyWesleyNutrition.com. My first and last name, Nutrition.com.
WendyWesleyNutrition.com. Okay, thanks always to our WMNF volunteers. Jessica Green is on the soundboard today. We didn't have a phone answerer. So thanks to you all for listening and being patient with us and supporting us. As you may know, we are gearing up for our next fund drive. Our goals have been really jacked up to make up for the loss of all of our government funding. Our theme is rooted in community, because that's exactly what we are. We are part of your community, and we need to rely on our community. So if you appreciate what I do here on Midpoint, I would really appreciate it if you could make a donation and show your support and direct your contribution to Midpoint Wednesday or MPW in your drop-down menu on the WMNF website. Next week is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and Midpoint will be joined by Eric Stillman, the president and CEO of the Florida Holocaust Museum, to talk about the major renovation of the museum, its recently reopened, and what the museum is doing and responding to in our current historical moment. So tune in. Now, Duncan is next with Talking Animals after the NPR News. We are WMNF Tampa, and we're out. Talking about it. I got them.